Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman, and Joseph Cooper is still away recovering from a severe back injury. He is doing better and appreciates your kind wishes. Well, today we take an inside look behind some of the most high-profile cases of the last 15 years and how their verdicts came to be. Joining us is trial consultant Richard Gabriel. He's the president of the American Society of Trial Consultants Foundation and president of Decision Analysis, a national trial consulting company. He's worked on the Casey Anthony and O.J. Simpson cases, among many other, and he's the author of Acquittal, An Insider Reveals the Stories and Strategies Behind Today's Most Infamous Verdicts, which explores the myths and misconceptions and illuminates the inner workings of our venerated criminal justice system. Welcome to you, Richard Gabriel. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks very much for having me on.
So let me get this just to begin. You're neither an attorney nor a mental health professional. Is that correct?
That is true. I am neither of those things, although from my background, I have some vestiges of those in my past.
Yes, and you seem to use both in your roles, in your role as trial consultant.
Yes, well, just to let you know, I mean, my father is a psychologist, my mother is a judge, and although both urged me to go into those separate fields, I resisted and sort of found myself in both of those fields. And over the years, I found myself in the role of sort of taking the law and taking much of the psychology of what goes into the law and trying to blend those to help my clients better understand either a judge's or a jury's decision-making in the case.
Well, tell us, I mean, you've just given us kind of a thumbnail of what you do. What is a trial consultant, and how old or new is this field?
A trial consultant, the field is actually 40 years old. Some of the older trial consultants have practiced in this field ever since the trials at Wounded Knee, the trial of the Catonsville Nine, and it was at that time where some of the social psychologists started looking at how to assist in especially high-profile cases where a jury's impartiality could be questioned because of all the media coverage in a case. And although we work in a lot of high-profile cases, trial consultants work across this country. There's the American Society of Trial Consultants, which has approximately 500 members across the country. And we typically engage in services in three separate areas. One is conducting a lot of research where we will do focus groups or mock trials or community attitude surveys to help understand a population, to help a client understand where particular biases are or particular attitudes may affect how a jury hears a case. We then also sometimes will do what you say communication strategy, in which we'll work with witnesses, help attorneys develop opening statements or examinations or closing arguments or even graphics to help better communicate and more clearly communicate the case to the jury. And finally, we'll help them in court with actually selecting a jury and or monitoring that jury's reaction to help them during the trial.
So who hires you? Is it the attorney or the client?
It's typically the attorney. It's important, actually, that the attorney hires us so that we enjoy what we call attorney work product privilege, in which the attorneys can basically spitball all kinds of ideas and we can have a free flow of information without it being discoverable by the other side.
Now, do you most often work with the defense?
We typically work with the defense, and although the book highlights a lot of the high-profile criminal cases, I work both with criminal defense attorneys and prosecutors on various cases, typically a little bit more with criminal defense. But a large majority of my work, and quite frankly most trial consultants' work, is in the civil realm, in helping both plaintiffs and defendants in civil cases better understand the dynamics of a lawsuit.
You know, it sort of surprised me that in these criminal cases you often work with a defense, given that violent murder of your very close friend when you were very young. I just kind of thought maybe you would choose to work with the prosecution.
Well, and that's one of the interesting sort of twists and turns in my life. When I was younger, when I was in, finishing up high school, a good friend of mine was murdered, and I struggled with that because there was a part of me that did want to just say the world is evil and, you know, we need to punish all people who commit these violent crimes. But
and that was a violent murder, if you would just describe it a little. They walked in, your friend and his sister, when the house was being robbed. Is that it?
Yeah, they walked in when their house was being robbed, and unfortunately they walked in at the wrong time, and I don't know the nature of how it happened, but essentially they were both beaten severely, and the sister was even sexually assaulted before they were both killed, and so it was... it was really horrendous, and it really shook me because I was only 17 at the time, and I couldn't understand how this could happen, especially because I lived in a very pastoral, very quiet neighborhood, and to see this happen. And so I struggled, but over the years I came to understood, partly because my father's a psychologist, and I studied the nature of I guess the criminal mind and how, you know, I guess partly I learned to forgive, and partly I also learned that, you know, really the inside workings of our criminal justice system, sometimes the optimal outcome isn't just pure punishment, that it's better sometimes for us to understand the nature of even mental illness and how that sort of gets enacted in criminal acts and how this happens. And there's this, one of the things I write about in the book, which I think is one of the important revelations for me, is this conflict that we have in our criminal justice system, which is that we take conduct which is on its face criminal, but we have a hard time dealing with the gray areas where somebody may have a mental illness, or they may be driven by desperation. And we don't have a way of dealing with that. We have these clear-cut rules, and the criminal justice system struggles with that because, on one hand, it's a system of punishment that says you broke the rules, you've got to pay the price. On the other hand, there are a lot of people that have fallen through the cracks in our society that do act out in a way that sometimes violates it, and sometimes it's better for us to understand what happens there.
Well, what would you recommend for them then? I mean, how do you think the criminal justice system should deal with those that are, you know, mentally inadequate or mentally ill?
Well, you know, again, I'm not an expert in this area, but we are starting to recognize, I think now, sort of the repercussions of mental illness in our criminal justice system. A huge portion of our prison population has been diagnosed with some sort of mental illness, mm-hmm. mental disorder. And so, you know, but we criminalize it. A large part of our law enforcement is really not trained in recognizing mental illness and those aspects. So we have drawn a very clear line instead of sometimes saying, how can we help this person who may technically look like they're violating the law? And you know, you even see in some neighborhoods they started setting up these things called community courts, which are typically more for minor offenses, but they start also understanding the dynamics of even kids who start ending up on the wrong side of the tracks and the wrong side of the law, and counseling them and coaching them so that they can become not necessarily just start down the track of being incarcerated and having that recidivism cycle, but that also they start getting back into the community, start understanding their behavior, and start rehabilitating themselves.
Well, we have a few minutes before we go to break. I want to start with the O.J. Simpson trial, the first of the sensational trials really in our time that I mentioned at the top was 20 years ago that Nicole Brown Simpson and Ronald Goldman were murdered. Could you just explain to us what was your role, if you would take us through what you did on that trial, kind of step by step?
Yes. I mean, it was it was extraordinary. I was friends and colleagues with Joelle and Demetrius, who at the time was going to be interviewed on Larry King Live. And I was sitting in the CNN studios when, and we were having a lot of discussions about the role of media in these high-profile trials, and lo and behold, the day that she was interviewed happened to be the day of the Bronco chase. So we had a discussion after that extraordinary day where 100 million people tuned in, and it essentially became the first reality show, and you know, sort of grabbed everybody and created what I call two juries, one at home and one sitting in the courtroom. We knew we'd be retained. Part of our job was to better understand who the jury was, how to pick a jury in that case, and how to develop strategies in order to help the defense team. What we ended up doing was conducting a series of surveys through a gentleman, a really quite extraordinary gentleman named Dr. Paul Strand in San Diego, who conducted some surveys, and we learned some very counterintuitive things in that case. One is that we thought that the prosecution was going to focus on women in the case because they had released the 911 tapes, and we knew that that was going to be a big part of their domestic abuse leads to murder theory. And we found out through some of our polling that women especially did not automatically make that jump, which was surprising to us, that some of those people were actually more understanding, more tolerant, and did not lean toward guilt as heavily as some of the male counterparts. That told us a lot. What also told us a lot in our polling, and we did some focus groups afterwards too, is that the more that jurors had heard about even what we consider to be very prejudicial pretrial publicity, the more they mistrusted the actual evidence in the case. And this is something I talked a lot about in the book, is that sometimes these high-profile cases, although it makes the defendant look guilty, it sometimes works against the prosecution, ultimately in the long run. The reasoning being that the jurors could not distinguish this highly sensationalized coverage from the actual evidence in the case. We obviously designed a questionnaire. We read the questionnaires, and we focused especially on, in our final selection, on jurors that had a negative experience of the police. And while a lot has been focused on the race of the jury, certainly race being a factor, we were focused on jurors, and nine of our final 12 jurors had very bad police experiences, either themselves, friends, or family.
Well, let me just stop you there for a minute. How did the prosecution allow them to be chosen as jurors? Don't they have that voir dire where they can object?
The process entails both sides allowing a certain number of, with unlimited number of challenges for cause, in which you can ask the judge to excuse juror for bias. And a certain number, I think it was 20 in our case, of peremptory challenges where you can excuse jurors. We think that the prosecution, and they had a consultant too, was focused on trying to get, they had, both Marsha Clark and Chris Darden had tried a lot of cases downtown Los Angeles in front of African-American jurors. And so they, I think, weren't as focused on that. I think they wanted women on their jury, which we ended up with a lot of, and didn't necessarily understand the research that they had done. And I don't think they really concentrated as much on the negative police experiences. And unfortunately, they missed it. And it, you know, obviously, because of our themes in the case, we had a lot of themes that had to do with the misconduct of the LAPD, which resonated with our jurors, and I guess the prosecution didn't think that was going to be important, or I think mistakenly they thought they had so much evidence that they could overcome those biases.
Well, this begs the question as to how one can get a fair and impartial trial when juries do have their own personal experiences and beliefs and biases.
Well, and it's a great question. And to tell you the truth, there's a book I talk about in the book called The Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, which he talks about the rationalist delusion. And the court system has this idea that somehow we seat jurors and all of a sudden all their fundamental experiences and beliefs and opinions just disappear and they can magically set them aside.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is, that's not what our system is about. Our founders actually said we should have citizen justice. We should have a representative cross-section of our community that hears the case. Now, at the time, they, of course, didn't appreciate the psychology, and it is an idealistic view. And so the notion of impartiality is a curious one because sometimes we truly are impartial. We don't have any interest in a biomedical patent case in which we have no understanding of the issues. But when it comes to a car accident or a murder or some case that or a doctor, a medical malpractice case, we all have experiences that, of course, we bring to the table. The important element for us, or for me and my work, is to not say, well, we can't have an impartial jury. It's to say impartiality is a process in which you better understand how jurors' life experiences and opinions affect how they do it and whether it can so impair their ability that they really shouldn't sit as a jury. Because this ideal of sort of neutrality to which no juror can know about it is a little bit of a fallacy, especially when you have something like the Casey Anthony case where everybody's heard everything about the case.
I want to get to the Casey Anthony case, but we need to take a short break first. We're speaking with Richard Gabriel. He's a trial consultant of 28 years and worked on some very high-profile cases, including O.J. Simpson, Casey Anthony, and others. His book is Acquittal, An Insider Reveals the Stories and Strategies Behind Today's Most Infamous Verdicts. We'll be right back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you, and Richard Gabriel, a trial consultant, and he has worked on over 1,000 criminal and civil cases, including some of the most high-profile trials in the last 15 years. His book is Acquittal, An Insider Reveals the Stories and Strategies Behind Today's Most Infamous Verdicts. So, Richard, let's move on to the Casey Anthony case. I can't believe I looked up that it's 3 years ago this month that she was acquitted. Now, what was your role in that?
Well, very early on in the case, Jose Baez called me up, and he had heard about me, and he said, look, I'm really having a hard time here because Florida has been just nonstop Casey Anthony coverage all the time. Nancy Grace had done over 100 shows at that point on the case and had coined the infamous Tot Mom verbiage for her, and he said, I'm getting killed in the media here, and I have to have a better understanding about whether it's even possible for me to even get a fair trial here. And so I counseled him, and because of some of my work on other high profile cases, we talked about it, and he said, do I need a strategy to counter all this negativity? And basically I took a look at it and said, really, no, because there's nothing you can do at this point. There was such a momentum built up of the negativity and the conclusion about her guilt for a very good reason. And one of the things I talk about in the chapter is that so much of the state, so much of the country became an active participant in that investigation. There was something about that smiling little girl's face that reached out to this country and said, help me, save me. And people donated money and volunteers combed the areas looking for this child. And when her body was finally found, people and the, you know, the conduct of Casey became revealed about some of her lies and her going out to party after her child was missing, the howls of outrage and anger felt very personal to, I think, a lot of people in the state and a lot of people in the country, making it very difficult to obtain a jury. So we spent a lot of time. I helped him with a change of venue motion, which was ultimately accepted and agreed upon by both the court and the prosecutors. And then we talked about strategy. I met with Casey Anthony. And ultimately, before the trial, we were able, because I was working pro bono, because she had no funds for this, we were able to get CBS.
Were the attorneys?
The attorneys, because Casey was deemed indigent, some of the attorneys were able to get some funds, including Jose, but it was very nominal. Essentially, you know, by most practices standpoint, the courts wouldn't allow funds for me. They wouldn't allow travel or funds for Linda Kenny Bodden, who is the forensic attorney who is going to be helping out a lot. And so it made it very difficult and very challenging for everybody to sort of sustain and to defend her in this tremendous onslaught that we had. Right before the trial, we were able to do a focus group in Orlando, and this really kind of extraordinary thing happened. CBS funded it, and they filmed it. And so we brought in a group of Orlando citizens and asked them, well, you know, have you heard about this case? And everybody said, of course. I said, what do you think? And everybody said, well, she's guilty. Of course she's guilty. And I asked, do you think she can get a fair trial here? And they said, oh, no, absolutely not. Too much, too poisonous. There's no way she can possibly get a fair hearing here. And I said, well, okay, let me walk you through most of the evidence that everybody knew about, because in Florida you have sunshine laws which allow every piece of evidence that's exchanged between the prosecution and the defense is a public record. So everybody had already viewed a lot of this evidence, and I walked them through it, asking some fundamental questions during the way, but most of it was what we thought the prosecutor was going to present. And at the very end, I asked a question, and I said, well, how many of you would convict her of first-degree murder at this point? And a stunning thing happened. Only three jurors raised their hands. And it was curious, and I said, "What? You all came in thinking she was guilty. What happened?" And they said, something doesn't make sense. Something doesn't add up. And this is where I have to admire the jury process, because even these people who knew that they weren't the real jurors took their job very seriously. And they said they dug into the evidence, and they knew that they weren't just sitting at home speculating about what happened here. They said, this is this woman's life, and it's a death penalty case. And they thought that some of the forensic evidence didn't make sense and wasn't credible. They thought that some of the motive evidence that the prosecution was saying, basically that she wanted to kill her child in order to be free, didn't make sense either, because Casey not only had a ton of friends who basically talked about how much she loved her child, but also she had a babysitter with her mother and father available all the time. And they basically came to the conclusion that the ultimate jury did, which is that we're not sure what happened here, but it could have been that the child drowned in the pool. And I asked them, I said, well, what was it about? Wouldn't you think she would say that? And the jurors said, there's something that happened in this family that makes her unable to admit what happened here.
What did they mean by that?
I'm not sure exactly, but they thought these jurors were more comfortable with not knowing, which is what I find an extraordinary quality in jurors, especially in acquittal jurors. They felt that, you know, there may have been some abuse in the family. that there was something about the family dynamic. And when you talk to the actual jurors after the trial, they spoke about, you know, the George's suicide note, and that he would, you know, try to commit suicide because of the death of his grandchild, and the fact that her brother was weeping on the stand because he wasn't allowed in at Kaylee's birth. And there were a number of things that just, and the fact that George, who supposedly loved his daughter, really gave some very damning testimony about her. And so there were a lot of things that for jurors said there's a family dynamic here, and that doesn't quite, that can make it psychologically so she doesn't want to admit this, and that there was enough questions about the timing of this and the motive of this that made jurors say, we don't accept an easy explanation for this. And ultimately, that's what led them, I think, to their to the acquittal in the case.
How does a criminal defense attorney decide whether or not to put a defendant on the stand? I'm thinking of Oscar Pistorius now, but in general, I would think that's a really tough determination.
It's a very, very hard, hard decision. And a lot of times they don't put him on the stand because, you know, there's so many risks. Because once they're on the stand, the prosecution can have pretty free range in terms of asking them a lot of various things. And, you know, we were challenged with it in the Casey Anthony case because Casey was the only one who could explain her state of mind.
Right.
She could explain what happened that day when, you know, when Osace talked about the child drowning. She could have talked about the abuse, and yet also she was caught in tremendous lies. And so would the jury then dismiss all of her testimony and discredit her completely? And this is often the conundrum that all attorneys have, even sometimes when you seemingly have a spotless defendant, is to, you know, how will a jury, even if they don't have a lot of problems in their testimony, how will a jury take minute nonverbal cues and interpret those as signs of guilt? So it's very tough.
You know, I know you weren't on the case of George Zimmerman, but if you don't mind, I read something that you wrote. Of course, he walked out of a Florida courtroom, a free man, 1 year ago yesterday. George Zimmerman did. You wrote, at the conclusion of this tragic case, we can divide again into camps of pro-Martin or pro-Zimmerman advocates and bemoan the lack of racial progress. However, instead of just shaking our heads and speaking sadly about how far we still have to go in the area of race relations, let's use this solemn opportunity to actually move the discussion forward. Then you say, just the fact that there's been so much peaceful reflection after this verdict shows a great deal of progress. Had you been a consultant on that case, would you have done anything differently?
I don't, you know, if I was a consultant for the defense, I don't think I would have. You know, I think that they did their job and focused especially on, you know, the Stand Your Ground law, which is what they used for his defense, which is, you know, in Florida, a reasonable belief, a reasonable fear for your safety can justify this type of force. If I was working for the prosecution, I might have done things differently, because it's a very tough law. I mean, it was a very difficult case, given the Stand Your Ground law, and even though it wasn't a technical Stand Your Ground defense, the jury instructions allow a jury to conclude that if a person reasonably fears for themselves, it's a very subjective criteria, then they're justified in using deadly force. So I think I would have advised the prosecution differently if I were working on that case, but I don't think I would have done anything differently for the defense.
Do you think anything will change or anything has changed as a result of that case?
I'm not sure. I mean, certainly we are more sensitized to the issues of race these days. I think we are having more discussions about it. You have, you know, tape recordings of Donald Sterling saying these terrible things, mm-hmm. and we start talking about it. My problem sometimes has to do with that. Sometimes our discussions reinforce the very racial stereotypes that we hope to dispel. And instead of just talking about race as skin color and differences, I think we need to start talking about race as a lot of different components and for the complexity that it has. The truth is that we all stereotype and we all have biases. And instead of vilifying the bias, instead of vilifying whatever, you know, any preconception we have about a particular group, as long as we start recognizing that we all have some inherent bias, whether it's against doctors or people from New York or people from different parts of the country or different, you know, groups, we have these stereotypes. And if we have better discussions about how those operate and admit that we do have some of those leanings and preconceptions and don't get so defensive about it, I think we can start better understanding how this type of bias works and how to get over it.
We're speaking with Richard Gabriel. He is a trial consultant. He's been one for 28 years and has worked on many of the last 15 years' high-profile cases. His book is Acquittal, An Insider Reveals the Stories and Strategies Behind Today's Most Infamous Verdicts. Another short break, and we'll return. And welcome back to Topical Currents. It's Monday's edition. Bonnie Berman with Richard Gabriel, a trial consultant for 28 years and president of the American Society of Trial Consultants Foundation. He's also president of Decision Analysis, which is a national trial consulting company. And he's written Acquittal, An Insider Reveals the Stories and Strategies Behind Today's Most Infamous Verdicts. If you want to join in today's conversation, if you have a question for Richard Gabriel, the number is 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@wlrn.org. Richard, how are judges chosen for a case? Does anybody have any say over who their judge is?
The individual parties do not have a say. Typically, a presiding judge in a courthouse assigns a particular case out to a particular judge, and when there's something that's going to be at least seeming to be a high-profile case, typically a judge or presiding judge will look for an experienced judge to hand that case over to.
So do you advise attorneys on how to deal with certain judges to work effectively with a particular judge? Do you learn about them, and is that part of what you do?
Well, part of what we study is the psychology of judgment and the psychology of decisions. So whether that be with a jury and a judge or even opposing counsel, what I try and do with my clients is say, here are some of the decision styles. Here's the preferences and life experiences and opinions of these particular judges, and here's a way to better get your argument heard by this judge or obviously by this jury. It's important to take all of these into account, because even though you can't choose your judge and you have limited ability to choose your jury or opposing counsel, it's important to be able to communicate your message and your story and your case in a way that creates movement for the judge, the jury, and opposing counsel in order to get the best result.
Do you ever have qualms or dilemmas about what you do, moral dilemmas about your work or the side you choose, or have you ever refused to work on a case?
It's a great question, and I'll say yes and no. In truth, I don't think of them as moral dilemma, because I do trust our jury system. Okay. And I do firmly believe that no matter how unpopular a case is, and sometimes I take a case because it's so unpopular or because on the surface it does look very bad, I still believe in our jury system. I still believe that every defendant or even every government entity is entitled to a fair process and a fair jury and a fair decision making. And if the scales tilt one way or the other, I feel that's kind of a stain on our system. So I don't have qualms about actually choosing to take those cases. I do sometimes have discomfort, which I pay attention to, because it's important for me to understand how a judge, how a jury will see an evidence and go, ah, that bothers me. This really disturbs me, in order to best advise a client. The only case that I probably wouldn't take is a death penalty case for the prosecution, because I don't believe in it. And I recently wrote an opinion for CNN.com where I talk a little bit about some of the problems that we have with the death penalty process in our country.
How do you think the 24-hour news cycle is impacting our system? Do you think it's a negative impact?
I think it can be a negative impact. I think there's net positives and net negatives. The negatives are that, especially in these high-profile cases, it really does invite a prospective jury pool to prejudge the evidence in the case. It challenges impartiality, and it makes it challenging even for the parties to discern it. I actually feel in the Casey Anthony case, this huge amount of coverage and sensationalized coverage of that case did them a disservice, because even some of the jurors afterwards said when the prosecution got done with their case, some of the jurors said, well, is that it? Because we've heard all this. They were expecting something new and different. Mm-hmm. And that was a problem for the jurors. And so it actually creates a lot of pressures. Sometimes witnesses come forward as a result of the media. So it creates a lot of pressures. But I don't think the solution is to shut it down, although, you know, a lot of countries do prohibit a lot of media coverage. We believe in our First Amendment. And I think we just need to better understand how the press coverage can affect it, and I think there needs to be better ground rules. I urge Jose Baez in the case to try and have a conference with the judge and opposing counsel and the media so that we can all sit down ahead of time and go, okay, how can you, as a media outlet, get the coverage that you need to be able to inform your public? What does the court need in order to be able to conduct an impartial trial? What does the defense need? What does the prosecution need? How can we have a discussion that sets some ground rules that helps? And I think if we better understand that, we have a better way of understanding how these forces apply.
How do you feel about the TV cameras in the courtroom? Is that advantageous to one side or the other, or does it depend on the trial?
Well, again, I don't think it's advantageous to one side or the other necessarily. The challenge is when the TVs get turned on, it does affect performance because there's more coverage. Attorneys sometimes think, well, how will this make my career? Sometimes prosecutors get political pressures that get exerted on them to more zealously pursue some things because those cameras are on. And it also creates what I call a social pressure, which is that now all of a sudden you do have a jury at home. And sometimes the jury itself is sitting there going, well, I want to base this on the evidence, but if it's an unpopular verdict, how will my friends and family view it? Will I get a lot of grief if I somehow give something that I know they're going to be unhappy with? So the television cameras, again, I don't think we should necessarily turn them off, but I think we should better understand how they affect the various parties and the process.
Why do you think so many of these cases go against popular opinion or the court of public opinion, as you put it? I mean, it happens so frequently now.
Well, it's, you know, I tell people this a lot, is that everybody has to understand, everybody thinks that there's so many of these cases that go down. The truth is that across this country, 90% approximately of places of cases get pled out to a guilty verdict. Of the cases that go to trial, still in most jurisdictions, 80 to 90% of those end up with a conviction. So we have to be have some context for really what happens. In high-profile cases, sometimes it is with defendants who can afford better attorneys
resources. I'm sorry, I was going to ask you about that. Where does having resources come into this picture?
It absolutely affects the quality of defense, and not just because there are great public defenders that I've worked with all over the country. So it's not just has to do with the attorneys, but the resources of hiring experts or investigators to go out and question certain evidence that's gathered against them. So it's the ability to hire not just better attorneys, but hire better investigators and experts to go out and question some of the evidence that's brought against you is part of our system.
Hmm. It doesn't seem like a very fair part of our system, though, does it?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, indigent clients, and, you know, I talk a little bit about this, you know, they have a much more difficult time. They are sometimes dealing with public defenders' offices who are way overburdened with their caseloads and don't have time to dedicate to their cases. And a lot of times there's a lot of other pressures that have been brought to bear. We've created a very pro-conviction atmosphere in our courts these days with mandatory sentencing guidelines and three strikes laws and a lot of political pressure to sort of convict people. And there's a lot of ways in which a prosecutor can essentially say to a defendant, do you really want to take the risk? Because if you get a conviction, it's going to go, you're going to get a lot of time here, so why don't you go ahead and plead to this?
Mm-hmm.
In California alone, we have, I believe it's 34 special circumstances that qualify you for the death penalty, including a circumstance which is essentially lying in wait, which is almost indistinguishable from just first-degree murder. Doesn't mean that it's always charged out.
What is that again? Would you explain that again?
It's one of the special circumstances that can qualify a defendant for the death penalty is kind of like lying in wait. In other words, if the prosecutor says, look, we're going to charge you with this a crime of lying in wait. In other words, you not only premeditated this, but you waited for the opportunity to kill this person.
Uh-huh.
That's really traditionally been a first-degree murder charge, not necessarily a capital offense. So what this does from a process standpoint is it allows a prosecutor to essentially say, look, unless you plead out just to the first-degree murder, I could charge this as a death penalty case. And they can get sometimes people to plead out to different things because they just obviously don't want to take a chance on being convicted of a death qualified charge.
And if they're innocent?
Well, you know, I talk a little bit in the book. The Innocence Project, at counting right now, is over 317 people that they have exonerated as a result of DNA testing and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt there's many, many more. One of the Innocence Project's cases I worked on with Linda Kenny-Bodden and Barry Scheck headed it up was in Tennessee, in which a gentleman had been on death row for like 23 years. And he had, his name was John Gregory House, I believe. And they found evidence which showed that the prosecutors in the original case had covered up blood evidence, and even a confession that the husband of the decedent had made at the time. Went up to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, this is ridiculous. Sent it back to the trial court. But the prosecutor ordinarily would have dismissed it, instead decided to retry him on the death penalty charge again. And so even there's all the time there is exonerating evidence that comes out that shows that people, you know, have been convicted and sent to prison or even executed for crimes that they never committed. And when people sometimes ask me about the unpopular cases I've worked on, I talk about these other cases because we need to have a full view of really what the system is. And for the most part, a lot of people are convicted, sometimes on questionable evidence. It's not to say that a lot of people are convicted because they're guilty.
Right.
But it is to say that the process tends to favor prosecutors. And I will tell you, there's been a lot more wrongful convictions than wrongful exonerations.
So what changes, if any, would you like to see? Do you believe our system does mete out justice fairly?
Well, the truth is that we talk about our system. I do believe our system is the best system. It's one of the ones that we do trust our citizens. So I wouldn't touch our jury system. People sometimes ask me about expert juries. But our system of having citizens decide criminal and civil cases, I think, is absolutely the best. I think there are reforms that can happen. I think there's better community courts. I think we need to make better decisions about whether our system is truly a punitive system or a rehabilitative system. We don't seem to be able to get our hands around which of those two things do we really want to have. I think we need to get better with mental health and understanding that and how that factors into criminal conduct. I think we need to have independent laboratories that test essentially evidence in cases, so it's not, you don't have undue pressure that are put on forensic, you know, examiners and medical examiners to render a particular thing that favors one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of things that I think we can do better, but on the whole, I think it is the best system we have.
Well, we want to thank you. Richard Gabriel is a trial consultant. He's the president of the American Society of Trial Consultants Foundation. What do you do, by the way, the American Society of Trial Consultants Foundation?
Well, we are studying a number of these initiatives that I would try and help to reform the system.
Okay.
We take a look at things like judicial decision-making and jury decision-making. I'm personally on a committee with the American Bar Association called the Implicit Bias Committee, where we are starting, you know, to look at what's the nature of bias. How do we address it in our system more effectively, as opposed to just trying to sort of sweep it aside? So we study these things, we make recommendations. Hopefully, at some point, we'll start to see some reforms happen.
Well, we want to thank you. Yeah, I read something you wrote about bias. It was very poignant, and I don't know where that was, a blog or, but...
It was CNN.com.
CNN.com, okay. Richard Gabriel's book is Acquittal, An Insider Reveals the Stories and Strategies Behind Today's Most Infamous Verdicts, and we'll have a link to it on our website. Thank you very much, Richard.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we thank you for joining us and spending your time with us today. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. And we do have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. And links, photos on WLRN.org and Facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Tomorrow's Topical Currents is an At Your Service edition on employment workplace issues with employee-side employment attorney Donna Ballman. And Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a good one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now.